The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, it's a first for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Leroy Chapman Jr. is the AJC's first Black editor-in-chief. He joins me in just a few moments as we talk about his nearly three decades as a journalist. We call that being very seasoned. And also now his direction for the AJC. Plus, former President Donald Trump is due to be arraigned Tuesday in a Manhattan Supreme Court. This after a grand jury indicted him last week. And everyone's talking about this, of course, including Mr. Trump. Meanwhile, here in Georgia, Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis has a deadline regarding Trump. A motion was filed by his attorneys to throw out a recent special grand jury report investigating attempts to interfere in Georgia's 2020 presidential election. So we'll talk about all this, what this all means, all that's coming up. But first, some other news items to tell you about. Parents and guardians from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras who have immigrated or were resettled in Metro Atlanta might be able to bring their children to Georgia with refugee status, as we hear from Emily Wu Pearson.
It's through the Central American Minor Program, a federal pathway for safe resettlement of kids. Laura Just is the Director of Legal Protection at the nonprofit Kids in Need of Defense, KIND.
There are so many root causes for migration from Central America to the United States, and that it is a very dangerous journey, that there are a lot of people out there, you know, who are exploiting people who are desperate enough to make it.
KIND partners with the International Rescue Committee to help families through the application process. Just says there are likely families in the Atlanta area who might not know they qualify for the program. Numbers from the American Immigration Council show 4% of immigrants in the state are from Guatemala alone. Emily Wu Pearson, WABE News.
Fulton County officials are celebrating the future opening of a center in Atlanta that will serve as the city's first all-hours alternative to jail. It will be operated and staffed by the Grady Health System, as we hear from Shemaine Cruz.
The Center for Diversion and Services will provide a person-centered approach for people experiencing homelessness, mental health, substance abuse, and poverty. At a groundbreaking ceremony, Mayor Andre Dickens said, "It was a game changer for public safety in the community."
This facility will be a safe and welcoming place with a sobering center where the person's immediate needs, such as food, shower, clothing, can be connected to their long-term care.
Police Chief Darren Shearbaum said that in 2021, the Atlanta Police Department responded to over 9,000 calls of a person in a mental health crisis.
That is not the role of the court. And when you look at the limited tools that an Atlanta police officer carries, you see our frustration.
The Atlanta Policing Alternatives and Diversion Initiative, or PAD, will continue to provide pre-arrest diversion services to local law enforcement agencies prior to the center opening in 2024. LaShondra Mitchell is a participant.
I think that is awesome. I think that we really do need something like this. I was recently homeless and PAD helped me, and I have my own place now.
This comes as Fulton County officials are planning for a new jail almost four times the size of the overcrowded facility on Rice Street, and a backlog of unresolved court cases caused by delays during the pandemic. Shemaine Cruz, WABE News.
Georgia will have two high-profile visits from Washington, D.C. this week. Tomorrow, Congresswoman Lucy McBath will host a small business roundtable in Gwinnett County. Along with U.S. Small Business Administrator Isabella Guzman, they'll hear the concerns of business owners, as well as highlight current legislation that's creating opportunities for growth. McBath and Guzman will also take a walking tour of small businesses in downtown Norcross. Then, scheduled for Thursday, Vice President Kamala Harris will make a second trip to Georgia this year. She'll tour a solar panel manufacturing plant in Northwest Georgia while promoting the economic efforts of the Biden administration. And the owners of the Q-Sales plant in Dalton are said to be investing billions of dollars into expanding their facility, as well as building a new plant in Cartersville, which is expected to bring about 2,500 jobs. This is reportedly one of the largest investments in clean energy manufacturing in U.S. history. Finally, Tiger Woods took some practice swings over in Augusta this past Sunday. Well, today is Masters Monday. The tradition, unlike any other, the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta begins later this week. And as Alex Helmick tells us, there could be even more attention than usual at this major event.
This tournament will be the first since members of the breakaway Saudi-backed Golf League LIV will play alongside members of the PGA Tour. There are only four, though. Two are former Masters winners, Phil Mickelson, the early face of LIV, and Dustin Johnson. Brooks Koepka and Cam Smith won other majors in the past to qualify. The Breakaway League offers big contracts and lured scores of PGA players over there and forced the PGA to change some of its own rules in the process and vow to up prize money as well. That last part is not a problem for the prestigious Masters, with a total purse of $15 million. The winner taking home about $3 million. Alex Helmick, WAB News.
Of course, the biggest storyline for this year's Masters could be the weather. As Gabriel Herzog wrote for Sports Illustrated Online, quote, "The Masters weather forecast is looking pretty terrible," close quote. Rain, heavy rain, and thunderstorms, all of that. So if you're headed to, make sure to bring an umbrella, a waterproof shoes, and a raincoat, because it will be wet. You're listening to Closer Look. We're back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has a new editor-in-chief after the retirement of its longtime editor, Kevin Riley. It's Leroy Chapman Jr., and his appointment was historic for the 155-year-old paper. Chapman is the AJC's first black person to hold the position of editor-in-chief. Nearly three decades as a journalist, what's his vision for the AJC? Well, perhaps I should ask him as he joins me now. Leroy Chapman Jr., thanks for taking time. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure, one, to be here, and two, I am a fan, so this is a big moment for me.
Now, you newspaper folk, y'all not used to microphones. being on the other side.
Yeah, it is. It's a little strange for me, but it's now part of the job, as Kevin told me.
We want Martha Dalton back.
I was wondering if that was going to come up, and the answer to that is no. But obviously she's done outstanding, tremendous work here, and we're glad to have her.
Yeah, we're glad to know that she's just not too far away. Incredible journalist, too, as well, as a friend and a colleague.
Yes.
Let's start here, because I remember reading, I think it was in the Dallas Morning News, this was a quote, "Studies show that distrust of the media has only deepened in these recent years of political polarization. No longer are news organizations widely considered credible sources of objective and accurate information," close quote. What do you make of that?
It's not surprising. I think one of the things that we have not done a good job of over the years, and when I say we, I mean the media collectively, is that as others have tried to tell our story, we've not been forthright in trying to defend ourselves. So we get accused of all manner of things, and we don't defend ourselves. And I think we probably suffered from a long time we really didn't have to. But the world changed, and I think it's important to do that. And then I think of one thing, too, that we are wanting to do at the AJC is to be transparent. I think that helps us. One of the things that we do is we will tell you why we're writing a story. Why are we devoting our resources to do this? Mm-hmm. How did we get the story? We'll show our work. And so that's part of some of the trust building. But I will say this, out of some of those studies you've seen where you talk about media broadly, If you really broke it down to local newspapers versus television, newspapers generally still lead in terms of trust. Mm-hmm. That trust has eroded over the years, of course. So if you measured a newspaper today versus 15 years ago, you'd see some erosion. But among media, newspapers still stand pretty strong.
And like the AJC and so many other news outlets across the country and here at WABE, we've had to change with how folks receive their information. There was another interesting study from Pew that U.S. adults under 30 now trust information from social media almost as much as from national news outlets.
Yes, that is distressing. So think about it this way. As a newspaper editor, my children, they don't rely solely on us. They don't even rely primarily on the AJC. Mm-hmm. And they have someone who is the biggest cheerleader of the AJC they've ever met in their home. So you know, it is a tough thing for us to overcome because things have changed. But I think one of the things that is important for us is to be present in the moments when those young readers, those young news consumers are coming to big stories. And we have to demonstrate our credibility. So we have to be in that mix. And when we are, we have to, again, demonstrate why we should be a counted upon essential source of information.
Well, the digital platform is so key because as that under 30 crowd, that's what they turn to. And you all have transformed, just like we have. We have an incredible digital staff team. I remember we only had like one person in our digital platform years ago. And now we have a crew, and we could obviously use more. I'm sure you could. So does that change then how often you all are putting out news?
It does. So we have to be a moment-to-moment news organization. So we can't spend all day gathering news and then at night building a printed product that is delivered in the morning. We have to be in the breaking news business, and we've worked hard to do that. So in my time here, which is almost 13 years, I've seen the transformation. Part of that was some partnership with our primary reporting partner, which is WSB TV and radio. And as partners, they did help us along the way, but we kind of found our footing with that as well. So it has changed us a bit.
I want to come back to that in just a moment because I want our listeners to get a little bit feel for who you are. You are a South Carolina kid.
Yes, I am. South Carolina kid, born
and
raised.
I was rooting for Don. But you know what? I'm happy for LSU, too. That's a whole other story.
I cannot tell you how much I was rooting for the Gamecock women to win and how disappointing it was to both my wife and I because we both went to the University of South Carolina, and she was really invested and was really disappointed.
How does a kid from South Carolina, military experience kid, so to speak, into a military adult?
Yes.
How did you get into the newspaper business, as they used to say back in the day? We're seasoned folks, so you might hear some terms that make us old.
Yeah, I won't make the story long, but I will say this, that it, I started as a kid wanting to do this, and I did newspaper, I did a yearbook when I was in high school. But then when it came time
Who
to go to college, I know. and I loved it. And so when it came time to go to college, the military became my ticket to college. So that took me off of the path of journalism. So in order to be a kid in the ROTC program, especially, you had to survive and keep a scholarship. So I became an English major, did that. But once I got out of the military, it was, well, what was I going to do? And had a very, I think, fateful meeting with someone who asked me the question about what you want to do. And I told her, and unbeknownst to me, she had been a journalist, a former journalist. Mm-hmm. And she introduced me to some people, and I wound up getting a job at the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina, working while I was a college student, and translated that into full-time work, and now I'm here.
What was that first story you covered? You remember?
Oh, I will never forget it. So the first story I got paid for, they sent me to write a feature, and there was a woman who is a beautician, and she spent her Mondays, which are traditional off days for beauticians, and what she did is that she went to Richland County, which in Columbia, South Carolina, is the county, and there were little girls there in protective custody. Mm-hmm. She would do their hair, and she spent all day doing that. So
that's a great story.
Yeah, so I went there and wrote about it. So I was allowed to sit there. It was great for me because we had a real staff photographer there, and I got to be a reporter from the state newspaper. And I sat and I got to tell their story. And I was instantly hooked because here's what I saw. I saw someone who was being part of the solution, who was just a citizen who wanted to give and who was moved by what the condition of these little girls. So these are little girls who are in protective custody. They've been removed from homes where there's been abuse. And she also recognized this, that with African-American little girls, often they did not get the kind of hair care products and care they needed for their hair. Mm-hmm. And she said, that's a self-esteem issue. You know, these little girls need to go into school feeling like they belong, not like they're, you know, condition, which as wards of the state, you know, there's a lot of otherness that a young child could feel with that. And I was just blown away by it. And I got to tell that story and it felt like a privilege. It didn't feel like work. It felt like I was doing something that was really important. And it didn't feel like work. So I really knew that's what I wanted to do after the first story I wrote.
How much is that covering that story stay with you, Leroy, to this day?
I tell that story to young journalists. If you want to talk about purpose-driven work, well, I got it the first couple of stories I wrote. Yes, I also covered sports and that kind of thing, too, and other stuff that, again, it's just part of the job. But I got those stories early, and that was tremendous. So I can't tell you what I did with $25 I made that day, but I was pretty poor at the time, so it went far. It went to great use, and I stretched the heck out of it, I'm sure.
You recently wrote in an op-ed titled, Dear Atlanta, I'm ready to listen and work on your behalf. And I'm going to read a portion of it because you talk about, mm-hmm. you said, quote, I want to be in Atlanta. I want to do right by this city, this metro region, this state. What does that mean? I want to do right by this region, by this city.
Well, if you get in a privileged seat like this, you have to figure out what you're going to do, right? And so part of this is an understanding that we've got to grow our business and we've got to survive in a pretty tough media environment. I mean, you mentioned some of the things that we're working against. So we have some headwinds there. But also, too, I understand that being in this position, there's influence here. And I want to be, I want to use it in the right ways. And so that means showing up. It means listening. It means telling the truth, no matter how uncomfortable. The love language of newspapers is to tell the truth, right? So we want to make sure that we're doing that as a news organization. But also, we want to celebrate Atlanta. And I have this firm belief. I think that Atlanta's capable. I think for any problem it's got enough talent. It's rich enough. There's ample resources here. But are we committed enough? And that's really the real question. Are we really committed enough?
Is there, you think, greater pressure on you to be fair because you are a black editor-in-chief?
Yeah, you know, I got the kind of blackness that will precede me. I mean, you know, my name's Leroy. So you walk in the room, I think there are assumptions made about
my
me.
My editor's name is Leroy.
That's right. That's right. So, yes, and there are presumptions, and I've gotten letters where they presume to know my politics and my family story.
Oh, you've got emails.
I get emails.
Let's talk about those emails. What you got?
It's a mix. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, there are congratulatory things mm-hmm. that say, I'm sharing with you this moment in history. I get mm-hmm. it, so it's not about me. And then there's some others that are like, well, you know, the AJC is doubling down on some failure. Look, oh, my God, they've handed the reins to this person who is the super woke DEI, and I'm sure there's someone else that this position should have gone to. It's amazing when you see the politics that are out there that mm-hmm. are pretty nasty and divisive on social media.
Oh, yeah.
There's nowhere where you're immune. There's no
Absolutely.
Moment that's immune. But, you know, again, I think that I don't want to give too much attention to that kind yeah. of thing. But the overwhelming response I've gotten, though, has been really, really positive.
And I can definitely agree with that. And I can I get it, too. Recently, I was called a, quote, crazed terrorist. A conservative plant.
Oh.
The N word.
Mm-hmm.
The B word.
Ah.
My favorite. I'm anti-vegetarian because I talk about barbecue a lot.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, it is something to see that because of the accessibility of everybody mm-hmm. And people who – and newspapers, I mean, we've been sort of nameless and faceless as journalists. Mm-hmm. So I get sort of the whatever the institutional grievance, it'll come to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always been the case. But, yeah, people can be pretty mean behind a keyboard.
And cowardly as well
oh, yeah.
Because they're behind a keyboard.
Right.
And you know, you have to let it roll off you. We're human. Sometimes it stings, you know. You all are being heavily criticized in the coverage of what people see as bias toward the proposed site for the fire and training, police fire training facility. What can you share about the conversations you have in that newsroom and now your leadership?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, that's one of the big stories for us and for this community, right? I mean, and our newsroom is a newsroom. Mm-hmm. So everyone brings their own experiences. So we have people who view this purely through the institution and the politics of it, right? Then there's policing itself. Mm-hmm. And that is an entirely, you know, separate lane of conversation and reporting. And one of the things that we, as we have that discussion, is that policing, there's a national narrative with policing.
Mm-hmm.
But policing is still a local story. Because if you think about some of the things that have happened nationally, they can feel like they're next door. Mm-hmm. And it leads to, I think, what we've seen in our country. And I think our country saw the Obama administration have one sort of set of priorities for the Justice Department in mm-hmm. looking at local policing, and then that got reversed. And then you saw some things. So, yeah, of course, there is a national story about this. But it's a local story, too. Well, what's our role? Our role is to tell the local story of policing. Our role is to tell the local story of the politics of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard sometimes to separate the national narrative with our local story. So that's where some of the tension lies, too, because these national narratives, you know, we're not exempt from them. Is there bad policing in Atlanta? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Is there bad policing in Metro Atlanta? Yes. Is there bad policing in Georgia? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But in telling a local story, too, you know, we can't walk away from some history also. And that is that we've had some leadership, too, that has done things that have not been done in other communities. I mean, we've had police officers fired and prosecuted here in ways mm-hmm. where other communities haven't. So I don't necessarily know if we're at the same point of where the national story is, well, is policing redeemable at all versus, well, if you put the right heads together to talk about what reform looks like, can you get there?
Do you see you all being and then it's a little bit different because I'm a host of a midday news show. I'm mm-hmm. also a journalist, and I've always said my job is to be fair,
mm-hmm.
not objective. They're two different things.
Right.
We folk can argue about that all they want, but my job is to be fair. It's not lost on me people's perception of public radio or NPR or WABE. My job is to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
What I've noticed also, Leroy, is with the younger journalists, and you know who you are out there. I've had conversations, and they have pushed back on me and said, well, I need for you to be more of this.
Yes.
I think this generation of journalists, I think, is different. I'm in the middle, and whether or not I like it or not, because I admire some of their tenacity, but I also want them to remember why they got into this business, at least why I think they got into this business, which is to be fair in reporting. And I say all the time, you cannot like a question as a guest, but was the question fair?
Yes. What a great question, too, and one that's pretty insightful to what we see.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's true. And there is legitimate conversation going on about what does it mean to be a journalist, and can there be both advocacy and journalism? And people begin to say that journalism, you know, we're not stenographers, right? We're just mm-hmm. not writing things down and letting people consume them. We have to contextualize them. We have to, you know, place them in history. We mm-hmm. have to explain why something is important. We have to explain the dynamics of power and things like that, and why someone, what's motivating one side and the other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what journalism is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in doing all of that, the question is, do you insert your opinion? And the answer for the AJC is still no, except for the opinion page.
Unless you're Bill Torpy.
Right. He's an opinion guy. and it's labeled opinion.
Right.
We let people know. Okay, so Bill Torpy can be Bill Torpy. And
Bill cracks me up. Got to get him on the show.
You should see some of Bill Torpy's text messages. They are even funnier. but that is an important question. And, you know, it is something that we're confronting. So if I think about, you know, what are the top four or five things I want to do? I want to make sure that as a leader, I want to be influential on training the next generation of journalists, because mm-hmm. I think what every community needs is a source of information that's trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And so even if you're driven by mission, you want to make sure it's trustworthy. And that's the danger. You don't want to align yourself, because once you align yourself, then it erodes trust even more.
When you say once you align yourself, can that be determined by the issue? You know, I covered sex trafficking for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
It is wrong, mm-hmm. obviously. There is no objectivity.
There's no both sides of that.
Right. Now, you can talk about, you know, in terms of legislation or laws, and you can have debates about that, but it is wrong. Mm-hmm. It is a criminal activity. It is wrong. And then from that, people say, oh, well, you're an advocate for the victims.
That becomes a matter of opinion. And, yeah. and let me say this. You know, there are things where you've got two sides that disagree, and they just have different approaches. And maybe you have two sides acting in really good faith.
Mm-hmm.
There are some things that I think a news organization, newspaper, should be advocates for. And we're advocates for our people, you know, meaning people who pay taxes, the community, you know, things are going to bring harm to the community. Well, of course, we're advocates for the people who want to solve those problems where the community is not being harmed. So, I don't think we take that to that degree where you neuter a news organization to say that all we do is just repeat what we hear. Mm-hmm. We don't. And we don't. And so there is some advocacy there that's very basic, but I think is expected, though.
What will you take from maybe what you saw Kevin Riley do or not do? And you mentioned your top five. How are you prioritizing this?
So Kevin was really good at being accessible and going places and listening.
Served on some panels with him. Yeah.
Yeah. And listening. So I want to continue some of that. So that means I will be less able to touch the content and less able to be perhaps involved in some of those meetings where
you're just going
to
let Bill Torpy run all wild and free.
No. And if Bill thinks that, and I hope he's listening, that is not what I'm saying, Bill. No, we'll have some other folks who will do the things that I used to do.
Yeah.
And I will assume the role that Kevin had, but I definitely want to do that. Now, in terms of the other things, though, they have to do with me taking over at a different time in the business. Because
mm-hmm.
when Kevin took over, it was more of a we're kind of turning the ship toward digital, and he pushed us forward. Now there's no, I mean, the ship is there. We are a digital organization. So now the challenge is, well, how do we do two things? I mean, we have to grow our audience, and especially our paid audience. So we have to be good enough for people to pay for us.
But for those folks who still like to go and get the paper,
mm-hmm.
you know, and will they get some of the same? I mean, obviously with on-demand news, they won't get what's something that's happening in the moment.
Right.
But how are you able to balance that?
Yeah, so there are people. We have a core group of people who only want print. And we're going to continue to print the newspaper. Now, will we look at other options, and will that be something that when they're holding my retirement, hopefully many, many years from now, you know, will there be a printed newspaper and a headline? I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. so that's the question. There's a business case for us to keep it and keep it around for a long time. And the question becomes, is it going to be still 7 days? Could it be something mm-hmm. in between? We don't know that yet. We have a new leader in our publisher.
Mm-hmm.
His name's Andrew Morse, and he's gotten here. And so we're going through the business case. But for right now, though, there's going to be no interruption to print at all.
What about podcasts? You all have been digging into my world. Audio storytelling.
Yeah, we'll do more of that. And we'll think about ways to do it. But, you know, I don't think there's anything that we could produce that's going to put you out of business at all.
I ain't worried about it.
But yeah, you make a great point. I mean, there are things where, and two things in particular, that are in the moment where podcasting makes a lot of sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those two are politics and sports.
Yeah.
So our Braves podcast right now, for example, is getting some good audience because mm-hmm. it's in the moment.
Yeah.
Fans want to come and talk about the game and analyze it in many ways. Well, politics, you know, we have a Politically Georgia podcast, and Greg Bluestein and Patricia Murphy are on that. And every now and again, Tia Mitchell's on it too.
Mm-hmm.
They've even invited me a couple of times. It's been months, so I'm sure I did such a horrible job that I won't be invited back. But
that's usually the case. No, I'm just kidding.
But But yeah, those are things. And then we got Breakdown, which is more of a longer term serialized podcast that's now really focused on what's happening in Fulton County with the Trump grand jury. Mm-hmm. So the question about podcasting is that I think we've got a suite of podcasts that we feel really good about. Mm-hmm. We'll be pretty judicious in figuring out what more we may be able to add, but we'll build on what we've got.
What is the Leroy Chapman Jr. leadership style like? I know everyone right now is gathered around listening for this, and they're taking notes. So 5 months later, they say, but Leroy, you told Rose this.
Well, I want to be inclusive, so I want to hear everyone. I don't walk into any situation thinking I have all the answers at all. So leadership style is certainly inclusive. I am attracted to smart idea people. So I'm not the type of leader who thinks I only have smart ideas. In fact, I would be very uncomfortable if I was the smartest person in the room, because that's a pretty lonely place, right? Where you have to have all the answers. And so that's part of leadership style. And the other thing too is I know that, and this is going to sound pretty corporate, but your people are kind of everything. Mm-hmm. But that's true though. So I'm spending a lot of time in thinking about hiring and development and those things, because ultimately, when you think about a newsroom and you think about what you're asking of people who go out and cover tough things, embed in communities, they have to work sometimes, depending on the story. It's not unusual to put in a 20-hour day. Just ask our politics team, who just had to cover Sonny Dye in the legislature or go cover a hurricane. So in doing that, you have to have the right people and you have to support them. So developing and supporting them. So my leadership style really is trying to be attuned to those folks. And I'm not going to ask anybody to do something I wouldn't do. Mm-hmm. Case in point, as we were thinking about, really all of us were gearing up for, whether or not Jimmy Carter was going to go on to glory. Mm-hmm. And I hope he's with us for a long, long time. But we know what was reported and what we all reported.
You have to prepare.
Yeah. And so in that preparation, there were times where we put the newsroom on shifts, and we were on shifts awaiting word. Well, I was on an overnight shift too, standing watch from 2 to 4 a.m. It felt like the Navy again. Except, unlike the Navy, I was usually out somewhere in the elements. And those watch shifts were 4 hours instead of two. But I did my 2 hours too.
Where do you see our industry in the next 5 years?
I think that good journalism will endure anything. So it's just a matter of how it's delivered. So I think our industry will endure with those who are smart and who produce the sort of journalism that people are willing to pay for. Will have a place. So I definitely see that. I think the technology and where we those consumer technology habits. I don't know exactly how. I wish I knew in 5 years what the big change will be, but there will be more change.
Absolutely.
So it's going to be two things: who's adaptable to that, and who continues to do smart work. And for the record, WABE does smart work. So so I just, in case anybody was wondering, asking, WABE is smart.
I didn't even ask him to say that. Leroy Chapman Jr., the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's new editor-in-chief, thank you for taking time. I really appreciate it. You know where a WABE hat out of here?
Thank you for having me. I have this mug, and I'm definitely going to put it to use. I'm probably going to get a swig of water with it right now.
All right. Appreciate it.
All right.
Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Closer Look continues now from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Before we continue with our next segment, some breaking news now concerning Professor Angela Davis, of course, a civil rights activist, member of the Black Panther Party. She was in town recently on March 24th, and she was participating in the Walter Rodney Day over at Morehouse University, Morehouse College, because I was over there. She writes, "The organizers of the conference sought to honor me with an official proclamation from the Atlanta City Council. I regret that I did not consider the implications of my acceptance of this award at the time, given the fact that the City Council voted in favor of the construction of a massive militarized police training facility in the South River Forest." Ms. Davis goes on to say, quote, in order to express my unequivocal solidarity with the activists who are leading the struggle to stop Cop City, who are protesting a police killing of environmental activist Manuel Esteban Pastoran, she feels compelled to return the award offered me by the Atlanta City Council. She goes on to say, the return of this award is not meant to diminish in any way the work of the Walter Rodney Foundation. I will always revere this great revolutionary whose spirit is so clearly reflected in the Stop Cop City campaign. And there'll be more on that later, we hope, from WABE News. Anyway, as we continue from WABE in Atlanta, guess what? Everyone is talking about it.
One hive mind. A misdemeanor that is well past its statute of limitations. In fact, what the case may be is that Alvin Bragg is beyond the law.
This is his worst fear, being mugshotted, fingerprinted, being referred to as a felon.
A lot of folks had a lot of stuff to say. Donald Trump became the first former president to face criminal charges when indicted by last week by a Manhattan grand jury. Now, the exact charges remain sealed within the indictment, but they're linked to alleged hush money payments to an adult film actress during his 2016 presidential campaign. Now, Trump could be facing a legal battle on two fronts, in New York, of course, and here in Georgia, for allegedly trying to sway the state's outcome in the 2020 presidential election. All that Fulton County Prosecutor Fonnie Willis will say is decisions are on the indictments are imminent. So what does this New York indictment complicate legal? Will this New York indictment complicate legal maneuvering by Willis's office? A lot to legally unpacked here. I should know because I'm trying to get through this. As we welcome, and I have a toothache, as we welcome former U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Georgia, Michael Moore. Thanks for taking the time.
Glad to be with you. I sure am.
Let's begin with your overall reaction to the indictment.
Well, I mean, I think we all knew it was coming. I don't think there's been any real secret about this, especially as we were getting the moment by moment play from the grand jury in New York. We'll have to see exactly what the indictment entails. I mean, I think that's the unknown for everybody. I mean, the public reporting sort of seems to indicate that it was probably misdemeanor type conduct, that maybe if it was attached to a federal election reporting requirement or campaign form, that may make it a felony. But that's we'll see. I have, and I think I may have said on your show before, I don't know that this is the case that I think is the best one to move forward on when we're talking about trying to take this historic step and whether or not a former president should be indicted. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, here we are.
And it's alleged, or at least by some news outlets and their sources, that Donald Trump faces more than 30 counts related also to business fraud. But as you just mentioned, we don't know. So what are the next steps here? I mean, Mr. Trump is expected to turn himself in tomorrow. Talk about media frenzy. The next steps in this legal proceeding and how long it could take before he goes to trial. Take our listeners sure. through all of this.
Sure. So it was planned and at least announced that he was going to travel from Florida to New York today, and he'll be arraigned and have his initial appearance in court tomorrow. That process really is a fairly quick court appearance. And before that, more than likely, he'll report and turn himself in to be processed. That sounds pretty ominous, but the truth is, it's basically putting some fingerprints in the computer system, and he's already been photographed so many times, they may or may not take a mugshot. I think there's a question about that, you know, whether or not they feel the need to do that and whether or not they can protect it if they do. And he'll give some biographical information that's needed for the record. And at that point, then he'll appear before a judge, and the judge will advise him. Of course, he's got a right to have a lawyer. We already know from the plethora of pundits that have been all over the cable news over the last few weeks that he's got lawyers. And the judge will say, you want me to read the charges or do you waive reading? My guess is probably his lawyers will have, by that point, seen the indictment. It will be unsealed. Mm-hmm. They'll waive reading of the indictment and with Trump's permission, and he'll enter a not guilty plea. And probably by the time the courtroom door shuts from him entering it, he'll be about ready to leave and go back out. And he'll be transported then back to by all accounts, the airport, and head back to Florida. So it's going to be a long process. I would tell people, you know, take a breath, really, because we're just starting this. And this, if you think about any case that you read about in the news, you hear something happens and 2 years later, there's a trial scheduled. You know, that could be what we're looking at here. I do think you're going to have a a litany of appeals. You'll have a great number of motions that will be filed and will be heard by the court as they sort of work their way through that. In this, they'll be talking about constitutional issues. They'll be talking about state law issues. They'll be talking about federal law issues and how those things all connect in this particular case. But I just think if it may very well be that it seems a little anticlimactic mm-hmm. after the first month of this, and certainly after the initial appearance, as we move through the regular criminal process.
Now, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says he'll fight the extradition orders. Can he legally do that?
He really can't. I mean, his duty is to enforce the laws, and the laws are such to move him forward. And I think that was pretty much just a gratuitous political comment. He wants to remind everybody that he's still in the hunt, that he may jump in the race, and that Trump's been indicted mm-hmm. and he looks like the savior. The problem for the Republicans that are coming out now and talking about this is that they're all afraid to lose this 25 or 30% of the electorate that has been attached to Trump. And so they're all coming now with their protestations about this indictment and the terrible DA and, you know, the process and all that. And, you know, for the first time, you know, in the last few months, we've seen they've been more worried about what books people can read and what bathrooms people can use. And now they're worried about a prosecutor named Bragg. Mm-hmm. And that's there was nothing to DeSantis's comments that he made. It was just pure puffery for nothing but the party faithful.
And if you are Fani Willis in your office now, because we've been waiting, it seems, months now for whether or not, you know, they were going to announce some type of charges for Mr. Trump. But now with this, how do you think this could possibly, you know, influence her decision? Does she need to wait? Would it be something that she talks to Manhattan DA? I mean, what are the scenarios here?
Well, it will be an interesting timing decision for her. And on the one hand, there may be some value in her moving forward quickly. My guess, though, is that she'll wait a little bit and sort of let the dust settle from this New York endeavor that we're fixing to see. I don't mean to say she'll let the case finish. Mm-hmm. I just mean she'll let the initial appearance hearing pass and some of the maybe a motion get filed, and she will be prepared as she moves forward. So, I think still within this late spring, I would not be at all surprised to see an indictment come out of Fulton County.
Meanwhile, she has been told by Judge McBurney to respond to an order from Trump to throw out the special grand jury report and toss out all the testimony from the investigation. What are the odds that Judge McBurney allows that to happen? She's got, I believe, till May 1st to respond.
Yeah, I think it's slim to none that he does all that. You remember that McBurney was the judge that presided over the special grand jury process. And so it was very methodical, and I think ran a pretty tight ship when it came into the way that special grand jury met, the things that they had to do, the way he handled witness disputes and subpoena challenges that came up, and made a good record in the case. The motion that's been filed, it's not unexpected. Again, I expect that they'll hold nothing back mm-hmm. when it comes to these cases out here, especially involving a former president. And frankly, they should fire every shot they have. I mean, that's what the process is about. But the motion is basically saying you don't get to use any of this information from the special grand jury and, you know, throw that out. The special grand jury was just icing. She didn't need the special grand jury to have the cake. I mean, the special grand jury has no binding effect on her whatsoever. So if she wants to basically put the report in a drawer and never read it, nothing stops her. And she is completely within her discretion to then present the evidence as she knows it or as her investigators have uncovered it to a regular criminal grand jury. So it has no bearing at all on whether or not the case ultimately could be indicted. The special grand jury didn't even have the power under state law to indict.
So if she's being asked to respond, obviously, to the request of Trump's attorneys, she's just, in a sense, presenting the information through their lens or the evidence that they have, right?
Well, so one thing that happens in these cases is somebody files a motion and the judge says, okay, well, I need to rule on it. But in order to make the record complete, in order to have a full recordation of what's happened here in this lower court before it goes up to an appellate court, we give them a chance to both sides to be heard. And so he simply has said, the motion has been filed. Now, Madam District Attorney, I want you to your office to have a chance to say what you want to say about it. Then I'm going to make my ruling. And then if somebody's unhappy with it, you're welcome to take it on up to the appellate court. And so this is just his way to sort of tie up the case for preparation if one side or the other wants to see it appealed.
So, again, so our listeners are clear on your opinion through this, is that there won't be any type of indictment of Mr. Trump while this issue with New York, Manhattan is underway, or it could be.
No, I think there will. I think there will be an indictment. I think that what's going to happen is she's going to let this week pass. Mm-hmm. I think that she's going to let his appearance in New York go ahead and happen. He'll come back and he'll make his speech and whatever he's going to do for the rest of the week and raise money off of the fact that he's been charged. And then she's going to make a decision, I believe, within the next. And again, I have no inside information mm-hmm. from her. But I expect that before we get into the summer, there will be at least an individual charged by indictment, if not a number of individuals charged by indictment in Fulton County. And that these cases will then run along somewhat parallel tracks. There'll be some decisions that have to be made about which case goes first, if there are conflicts.
And that decision has to be between the two DA offices here?
The judges that are overseeing those cases.
Okay.
So this case now in New York, think about it this way. The DA has taken it. He's had control of it with the grand jury. He's now handing it to the judge, and now this judge is running it. Mm. So now in Fulton County, the DA still has it. At some point, if she seeks an indictment against one, she'll give it to the judge, and the court will have control of that case. Mm. And so those two courts will then, they'll set things, and they'll accommodate each other, and they'll make sure, because you got one defendant charged in multiple jurisdictions, if that's the case, that there's not an overlapping of, you don't have to be in the same place at once, basically, and that the lawyers have the opportunity to appear at the different places and times they need to. But there'll be some coordination. But the New York case is not going to mean that the brakes go on the Fulton County case. Mm. It just simply means that she's going to let this week pass, I believe, and sort of get the first appearance here behind them. She'll get a chance, as well as the rest of the public, to look at the indictment, see what he's been charged with, hear what his lawyers have to say. And that just puts her in a better place as she makes a decision about whether or not she's going to present the case as she has it to a criminal grand jury here in Georgia.
And Attorney Moore, what do you just make of all this? Of course, unprecedented, obviously, but just we've been talking about this for a while.
Yeah. My concern is about all of this has just been the loss of norms. And I really worry about without commenting on whether or not the conduct was criminal or not criminal, or whether or not there's a meritorious defense, I look at this and I think about what this means 20 years down the road, 50 years down the road, mm-hmm. for somebody who's leaving the White House. And does that mean that they can just expect to have a local DA somewhere in the country who happens to be of an opposite party charging them with a crime and or presenting a case to a grand jury? And that concerns me. I think that's just a follow on to the same sort of attacks we saw during the past administration, with some of the attacks on the institutions, the government institutions, even encouraging some of the things in January the 6th. And, mm-hmm. That to me is the real loss. I think that if anybody's waiting on a perp walk for former president, that he's going to be hauled into the mm-hmm. penitentiary, you're going to see him working on a chain gang on the side of the road or whatever it is, or worker. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Just not going to happen. And so we've suffered a lot of damage yet to be known, I think, to our government and to our norms and our governmental institutions. I think we've lost some stature probably in the world. This is what we expected in other places, that the former presidents were charged. Again, doesn't mean he's above the law. Doesn't mean he shouldn't be charged. Mm-hmm. I just simply worry about what it means in a larger context.
Yeah, in terms of norms, it's kind of hard to remember what it's supposed to be like, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, when it becomes normal that you can just listen to things that are completely untrue and somehow give that a pass, I hardly know how to comment to that. I mean, I don't think you'd let your children come and state a bold-faced lie without addressing it. And I don't know why we've got to the place where we somehow give politicians a pass for that.
Mm, we could have a whole nother show on that.
Right.
And then I'll get more emails. Former U.S. attorney. I think I'm going to publish my emails.
Right. That would be.
Now, can I do that? And will I face any legal? I don't want to get sued because I don't have no money. But will I get sued if I just publish all the emails that I get? The good, the few bad, and the very absurd.
You know, sometimes it's interesting to read emails, and you might edit out or redact the person that's sending them, and certainly their contact information. I will tell you that sometimes I do commentary, sometimes for some other networks, and there are certain ones I know that by the time the TV camera goes dark, that I'm gonna have a hate message in my voicemail, and so you sort of accept. But again, that's sort of what makes us great, right? Is that we can express different opinions, we can comment about it, we don't have to agree. There again, one of our losses has been the lack of tolerance for people with different views.
Yeah. I mean, you can have a difference of opinion. You can express that. Don't know if you need to call me the N-word, but you know.
No, you don't need to do that. Right. And I think that's.
Do you? as they say.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. No excuse for the personal attacks and certainly those kind of that kind of language. And that's one of the things I think that we've seen change more recently is that somehow that kind of commentary, whether it be, you know, racial slurs or comments about other people, you know, those things have somehow been normalized. And
you
that's
get, look, you get one or two a year.
Yeah.
I'm good. Former U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Georgia, Michael Moore, as always, thank you for taking the time and offering your opinion. I really appreciate it.
Great to be with you, Rose. Thanks so much.
All right. That's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson, Daniel Razel. Tiffany Griffith is our supervising producer, and our engineer is Sawyer Vanuworth. As I always say, send me your emails, rose@wabe.org. I'm open to it. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now plugged in, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.